Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the NBA Podcast. We're going to close out our division previews with this week with a look at the Atlantic Division. Before we get underway, just wanted to remind you that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. In our bio, you can find all of our Twitter handles, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes, so please subscribe, download, leave some reviews. We would love any feedback. And we're being hosted this year on FanRag Sports, so check them out on Twitter at FanRag Sports and for their NBA content at FanRag NBA. Joining me today, as always, are my two co-hosts, Morten Jensen and Sarah Chalea. How's it going, you two?
It's going well, Brian. It's somewhat early for me this time around, which is weird because I'm always used to late hours when I'm recording with you guys. So this is very surreal.
Yeah, we appreciate the flexibility there. Dinner time for you. It's even earlier for us. Oh. I've been up since 7 because I had to go get a Super Nintendo today.
Oh my God, no. 7?
Yeah.
Wow, Brian. Yeah. It's not like I was woken up at 5 by my 6-year-old. No, no. 7.
Hey.
Good Lord.
I don't have a kid yet for that exact reason. I have an annoying dog.
Yet.
That's it. Sarah, how's it going with you?
Good. I'm slightly jealous of your Super Nintendo, but remain mainly hurt that they didn't put the Ninja Turtle game on there.
Oh, I know. I'm really bummed.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't even touched it yet because I need to get through a little bit of writing today, and I know it's just going to be like 5 hours of Mario Kart once I open that thing. We also have a special guest today joining us. We have Jared Dubin, who is a prolific freelancer. Jared, how's it going?
I'm doing well. Thank you guys for having me. I gotta say, I feel like a little bit of a fraud. I only got up at 8 o'clock today.
Oh, no. Don't worry. Usually I sleep till like 9 because I'm basically unemployed. Jared, before we get started, could you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and where they can find your work?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at JADubin5. I usually put up all my work there. There's a link in my bio to my personal website where you can find all my archives at the various different places that I've written. I still pop up at Vice Sports, at Fanside, at The Step Back, and several other places as well.
Very good. Yeah, please give Jared a follow. He's a great resource, especially if you are a Knicks loyalist. And if you are a Knicks loyalist, well, you've had quite...
What are you doing with your life?
that is the first question. But yeah, you've had quite an interesting summer. So, Jared, even before the Carmelo Anthony trade, we were saying we wanted to have a Knicks guy on for this episode because, as you know, I'm Philly, and I didn't want to inundate Morten and Sarah with more of that. Luckily, the Melo trade happened, so now we have even more to talk about. We had one podcast last week where we discussed kind of just the instant gut reaction ramifications of it. But now that we've all had some time to process what it means, you know, we mostly focused on the OKC side last week. So now we can look at the Knicks side this week. And Jared, I want to start by asking you, you know, Carmelo is now gone. So Kristaps Porzingis is now the face of the Knicks franchise. That means he's going to have more defensive attention sent his way. If he struggles, the New York media is going to be all over him. Do you think he's ready for that kind of pressure?
I don't know that it matters whether he's ready for the pressure or not, because it's going to happen either way. Mm. You know, he's been sort of a media and fan darling so far, because it's pretty much been established that he's going to be the face of the franchise, and everybody loves him for that, but he hasn't actually dealt with the reality of it just yet. It's always been like, oh, well, you know, we've got to get Carmelo out of here so we can get the Kristaps era underway. And now, obviously, you know, whether he's ready or not, it is underway. And it's going to change things for him in his dealings with the media. It's going to change things for him in his dealings with fans. It's going to change things for him on the court. You know, based on everything I've seen from him over the 2 years that he's been with the team, I think he'll be able to handle that. He's, you know, a very personable guy, a very likable guy. He deals with the media very well. Obviously, the fans have grown to love him very quickly, and I think his game will lend itself well eventually to being the focal point of an offense. I think the issue on that front is that he's a big guy, and a lot of the times he is going to need guards to get him the ball, and the Knicks have, I think, you can double check me on this, but they have, I think, -4 guards on the team, and none of them are really equipped at creating shots for others. So I think that's going to be a little bit difficult for him this year. And obviously that will lead to a whole lot of losses for them because they're going to stink at defense too. So I think there's going to be some growing pains there, but I don't think he'll – it's not going to be like he's going to crumble under the weight of having to carry the franchise. I think that he's perfectly well equipped to do that once they actually put him in a good position to succeed.
Yeah, right. The lack of talent surrounding him is going to be an issue this year. But hey, you know, the NBA just approved lottery reform, so this is the year to tank if you're going to do it. Mort, I want to ask you about Jared, what is your nickname for Frank Ntilikina again? It's like Frankie Smokes, is that right?
Yeah, it's Frankie Smokes. It's sort of like it's a play on the nickname that Jason Concepcion, who you all know is from The Ringer and The Maester and Watch the Thrones and or Talk the Thrones, whatever it was called this year, and Binge Mode. He came up with the name Frankie Nicotine, so I shortened it to Frankie Smokes because I think it's cooler.
That's spectacular. So we're only going to refer to him exclusively as Frankie Smokes from here on out. And Mort, I'm going to ask you about Frankie Smokes himself because this was the year of the point guard in the NBA draft. We had 5 selected in the top 10, 2 in the top 2. Dennis Smith at 9 drew a lot of attention at Summer League because he played so well. De'Aaron Fox, is probably going to get not as much run this year because the Kings have George Hill, but he's viewed as the point guard of the future in Sacramento. And then we have Frankie Smokes, who I feel like didn't get as much attention or hype. Or, there was a story, especially about Dallas, how like they tried to mislead the Knicks into thinking that they wanted Frankie Smokes and they really wanted Dennis Smith Jr. And then when they took Frankie Smokes at 8, the Mavericks got really excited. So do you think Frankie Smokes... I love that name.
It's a great name.
Do you think he is the caliber of player where, like, the Knicks aren't going to immediately regret not taking Dennis Smith Jr. over him? Or do you think, that's already going to be a mistake?
No, I don't think it's – you can't answer that this soon. Neither have stepped foot on an NBA court really so far. And to be fair, Ntilikina has a great physical profile at a point guard position, 6'5", roughly 200 pounds. There's a lot of potential there. He's got great court vision. He's defensively acclimated, and that three ball could come along pretty well. So I'm not down on him by any stretch of the imagination. It's just that when you have Dennis Smith, who just showed that much, and he's that athletic and has a scoring punch to him, that the Knicks really need, it kind of compounds the fact that, they didn't get that type of guy. But that doesn't mean he's not going to be pretty damn good in the future. And who knows? Like, that European mentality might actually come in handy when getting paired with Kristaps. As our favorite coach, Coach Popovich, have said several times, it's that, European players come over and the level of ego that they bring with them is just significantly smaller. They are more inclined to let more established players get their turn or establish himself to a greater extent. So I think Ntilikina in that way more mentally complements Kristaps a lot more. But in terms of raw talent, I do think Dennis Smith Jr. has a little bit more of it. But that doesn't mean that Ntilikina is going to be a bust or anything close to it. I'm still excited to see what he can do on the NBA level.
Yeah, me too. I think, he's going to unfairly, if Dennis Smith hits the ground running, it's like no matter what, he's always going to have that comparison. But I'm excited to see him too. I think I'm with you. I don't think Knicks fans should already be out on him because Dennis Smith Jr. played well at Summer League. I'll say that much.
No, but it's tradition, though. Yeah. Knicks fan has to be out on somebody. Right. I mean, if they and look, they booed Kristaps. Yeah. Look what happened. That's true. they should just continue boo everyone. It's gonna be great.
Right.
Just quickly on that front, Knicks fans do boo everyone. Every pick since Patrick Ewing has been booed, except for two guys, Mark Jackson and Andy Routens, and it's because they went to New York colleges.
Oh God! Oh, Andy Routens. Hey, I mean, it worked with the Eagles. They booed McNabb, and he worked out well for a while. So maybe that is the play. Just boo all of your draft picks, and then they'll get pissed and turn out to be good.
It's been working out super well for the Knicks over the last 30 years.
Yeah, I was just going to put up a Ronaldo Balkman reference, but yeah, you get it.
Oh, man. Sarah, I'm going to save the center question for Jerry because we talked about that last week. So I'm going to ask you about Tim Hardaway Jr., who signed... One of the more egregious contracts of the summer, 4 years, $71 million. It was like the Knicks thought we were back in 2016, and they handed a 2016 contract out in 2017. That said, you know, now they don't have Melo, so they need kind of a takeover go-to option on the wing. Do you think Hardaway Jr. can be that guy, and do you think he might actually return close to positive value on that contract?
Well, I'm not going to touch too much the contract. You guys know that's not my area of expertise. I'm coming around, though. I'm coming around to, I understand the basics of, apparently, the short-term deals are usually pretty good thing. Mm-hmm. You don't want to lock into the longer-term deals. I'm getting there, guys.
The Knicks did not.
Yeah. I don't, you know, I'm not clear how much it really matters this year. Obviously, you don't want to be locked in to that deal, but I don't think he's a takeover kind of guy. I think, you know, you can expect him to bump up his per game scoring average a little bit. I think he's at like 10, so you could get 15 maybe out of him, maybe a little more. He scores 64% of his shots in the restricted area. That's pretty good for a guy his size. He has like a career 35% three-point shooter. You'd like to see that bump up a little bit. But the thing is, like, more than 80% of his threes are assisted. So it goes back to what Jared was saying about Kristaps as well. Like, who's passing him the ball? That's the big right. question mark this year for the Knicks. So we're gonna have to see. I mean, hopefully, I think Frankie Smokes, you want to be that guy eventually, but this year has to be just about, like, throw him into a bunch of pick and rolls with Kristaps and just see what you've got. I think the kid has a lot of potential, but, you know, don't put a lot of pressure on it this year. Just get those reps in.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I he played really well in Atlanta, so I think, you know, it's not going to be like a repeat of his first tenure in New York, so that's that's at least a slight silver lining. I you know, he's going to have a very tough time living up to that deal, as many of the wings, you know, like Kent Bazemore signed 4 years, 70 last summer, did not live up to it. Evan Turner, 4 years, 70, did not live up to it. Like, that's just a tough, you know, when you're making almost $20 million a year, the expectations are so much higher for you. And if you're like kind of this complimentary wing player, it's often just not, you're not going to live up to that. But, you know, I'm mildly optimistic, especially now that Melo's gone, that he can be that number two scoring option, because really the Knicks, they just don't have anyone else. Like, Courtney Lee, like Doug McDermott, it's just, I don't know who else is going to slide into that role. So I feel like just by default, Hardaway Jr. is going to jack up 20 shots a game, and then, you know, that's 20 points right there, hopefully. Jared, we talked last week about, you know, Cantor came over in the Melo deal. So now the Knicks logjam at center is even more jammed, because now you have Cantor, you have Willie Hernan Gomez, you have Kyle O'Quinn, and you have Joakim Noah once he comes back from his suspension. I think he's got 12 games left, if I'm not mistaken. So who would you like to see them start at center?
Hernan Gomez, and it's not particularly close. To me, at this point, any minute that Noah spends on the floor is a wasted minute. He's whatever he is, 31, 39, who cares? He's not part of the future in any way whatsoever. And, you know, even if he gives you, say, a 5% better chance to win the game than Hernan Gomez or Cantor do, well, that's not good for you in the immediate term anyway, especially in the last year that tanking exists. Or the idea that this is going to solve tanking is nonsense anyway. I think the Sixers fan on the podcast would agree.
Yes.
But I think it's got to be Hernan Gomez because, A, he is under contract for, you know, a longer period of time at a extremely good contract, one of the better non-max contracts in the league at this point, considering his production last year. He basically brings, I would say, like 80 to 90% of Cantor's offensive production with better mobility on defense for like 1/9 of the cost. So I would much rather have him be that guy than Cantor, and Cantor can continue scoring at a slightly above average rate against bench defenders.
Yeah, that's where we settled too last week, so I'm glad to hear we weren't totally off base, because, you know, I had to keep track of the Knicks for fantasy purposes, at least toward the end of last year, and once Hernan Gomez moved into the starting lineup toward the end of last year when Noah got hurt and got suspended, it seemed like he and Kristaps played really well together. So I don't know, you know, if they're really embracing this youth movement, I don't know why they would shy away from that. Like, I feel like you'd want to continue building the chemistry between the two of them, but then the three of us also said, well, they are the Knicks, so Cantor's probably going to end up starting.
They might end up starting like Doug McDermott or something. I don't know. Oh, God. Can we talk about another team?
Yes, let's move on to the Brooklyn Nets before we get too depressed, although that might not help, actually. Mort, we got to talk about D'Angelo Russell first and foremost, because, you know, the Lakers basically gave up on him. They got the number two pick, they knew they were going to get Lonzo Ball. The writing seemed to be on the wall for D'Angelo, and then right before the draft, they pulled the trigger, sent him to Brooklyn with Timofey Mozgov for Brook Lopez and a late first-round pick, which is, you know, given the Lakers' plans next year, it's basically they were trading for an expiring. So they, you know, they really, they gave him up for a plan B, basically. Do you think he has any chance of kind of reviving his career in Brooklyn and making the Lakers regret giving him up for so little?
I think you've asked me that question three times on this podcast, actually, over the course of the offseason.
Probably.
I will not change my answer. Yes, I think there's plenty of chances of him breaking out in Brooklyn. He's going to play at a primary role, and he's probably going to get a hell of a lot more minutes than he did in Los Angeles. He's entering year three, which is always like that one year where you take that step up, where the NBA game kind of slows down for you. He's still got the ability to shoot. He's got ability to play make, and he's basically been handed the team. So I think there's every opportunity to be optimistic about his chances in Brooklyn. Yeah, I'm a big believer in him breaking out this season to a pretty big extent. I would be surprised if he didn't do it, like, overwhelmingly so, like in 22, 23-point average.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm right with you. He's one of my favorite guys to target in middle rounds of fantasy this year, because I just think a huge breakout is coming. You know, they don't have that much young, like, high-caliber talent. They have a lot of, like, interesting flyer guys who we'll talk about in a little bit, but, like, they don't have, you know, they just, because of the Paul Pierce Kevin Garnett trade, like, they didn't have the draft capital to get that, like, high upside young prospect. So, like, this was their one shot to get it. They're going to turn the team over him, I think. You know, Jeremy Lin's going to be there in the backcourt as well, which I think is only going to help, because you can play, you know, the Lakers at the end of last year seemed to realize that D'Angelo, you don't necessarily want him as your full-time ball handler. So now, next to Lin, you can kind of play them interchangeably. Like, Russell could be, you know, they're not even, I don't even think they're going to, like, call one, like, the point guard and one the shooting guard. Like, they can each play both roles. But, like, D'Angelo will probably operate off the ball more than he does on the ball, which is probably better for him. Like, he can play the complimentary ball handler role, serve as a catch and shoot threat, slash cut more, you know, work in transition more. I think, you know, I'm expecting big things from him this year. The attitude concerns seem, you know, who knows what, if it was like the LA spotlight or, you know, the Nick Young thing. Like, it was just no getting past that in LA.
Don't bring up the Nick Young thing. It was so stupid. Like, Nick was the one who did something wrong there. I'm just, I can't. Yeah. I still don't understand it. I think it was blown out of proportion to a perverse degree. I don't think that one thing just kind of labeled him as, like, a problem child, and, you know, like, he was just meant to have a career where he was immature for the duration of it. It's such baloney, really.
Right.
I mean, he's 21, and when that happened, I think he was 20. Like, come on, he's a kid. Jesus.
I don't know. I mean, it seemed to sour the Lakers. You know, the reports that came out at the time said, like, the Lakers locker room basically froze him out. So I don't know if there was any getting past that in LA particularly. But, like, now that he's on a new team, I'm hoping it's a non-issue. Like,
it seems like snitches get stitches, and in a team like LA, I mean, look, we all know what magic he did in his spare time when he was playing.
Yeah.
He sure as hell wasn't staying faithful or anything, so when someone, you know,
right.
blows the whistle, it's like, oh, that's not good. Yeah. I really don't think it's an issue. I'm all in on D'Angelo Russell for this season, which is also why I have Brooklyn as like not going into the playoffs. No, hey, but I'm just saying, I don't think they're going to be as bad as people think.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I don't. You mentioned them as like a potential sleeper playoff team, and I can't get there.
Yeah. It's the East. Yeah, come on.
I alone
with a broken leg could make the playoffs in the East. Come on, give me a break. So bad.
Sarah, I want to talk about Timofey Mozgov with you, because Brook Lopez, you know, last year he like suddenly learned how to shoot three-pointers, and he was by far the Nets' best player, in large part because Jeremy Lin was hurt for most of the year and they just had no one else. So losing him is going to be, you know, a big deal. D'Angelo will help compensate for the offense, but now you've theoretically either got Mozgov as your starting center or a rookie in Jared Allen. So do you think Mozgov is as washed as he looked in LA last year, or do you think he actually has a chance to play, you know, he's not going to be a huge scorer, but like, can he continue to play decent defense and rebound at an above average rate and just give them whatever they need at center?
He'll be okay. Yeah, like, he's not going to be great, that's for sure. But, you know, he was not, I don't even know if decent is the word, a decent role man last year. I think he scored like 1 point per possession, which isn't great as a pick and roll role man. But that's really, if he could just do that and somewhat try to gum up the lane on defense, that would be fine. I think they need to get Jared Allen out there, though. I don't know how much he's ready, but I just want to see him develop. He has the potential to be a great lob target in pick and roll, so I would like to see that. Because I mean, it's hard sometimes to evaluate these teams that are so far into the rebuilding path. You know that it's not going to be great on the floor, but you know, you still want to see what they can put together. So really, the target for him is just be a decent role man. Like I said, you know, you hope that Alan Crabb, you've got out there now, who can hit the three, can space for that action in the lane a little bit better, and you know, just see what they can get going. You know, you have Russell, who's proven that he can score. Lin is a good pick and roll man, ball handler, obviously. So I want to see if they can get a little something going there.
I think this is where the Nets are going to be better than people think argument sort of falls apart. I know that they should have Jeremy Lin healthier than last season. They have D'Angelo Russell now. They have Alan Crabb now. But people are really underrating how much just the presence of Brook Lopez lifted them toward the direction of competence, and not having that guy at that position is going to really hamstring them, I think, on both ends of the floor. They don't really have somebody that can defend even at center, and they certainly don't have someone that can step out and hit threes or provide the kind of role man presence or post up presence that Lopez could. It's going to basically be entirely on Lin, Russell, Crabb, Caris LeVert, and Rondae Hollis-Jefferson to carry them toward whatever they're going to do, and I'm not sure I see that happening just yet.
Yeah, I think, as we've all said, the Lopez thing is going to hurt them more than... I mean, he was just, like, he flies under the radar because he played in Brooklyn last year and Brooklyn was so bad. But, like, he played really well. He's going to be a really valuable addition to that Lakers team this year, and it's why I'm higher on the Lakers than probably the average person out there right now. So, Jared, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I guess you could... I hesitate to even say this, but I guess you could try some, like, small ball with, like, Trevor Booker at the five, but that's not... your rim protection is still going to be awful. Like, there's no good solution unless Jared Allen is ready to go right away. Yeah. But let's talk about Alan Crabb, Jared, because the Nets got him for absolutely nothing. Portland regretted handing out all of the money last year and had to salary dump some of it to just get away from the luxury tax. I think they were going to owe like $40 million or something in luxury tax this year if they kept their whole roster together. So they sent Crabb for Andrew Nicholson, who they promptly waived. Crabb, now theoretically, he should start, move into a starting role at the three. I think he's already, he's in a walking boot right now, I want to say. So he's missing a little bit of training camp time. Hopefully it's not too serious. But what do you expect from Crabb this year? Do you think he breaks out now that he has more of an opportunity?
I don't know that they really need him to necessarily break out. I think if he does basically what he's done in Portland the last couple of years, shoot 40% or better from three, play competent wing defense, you know, do a little bit with the ball in his hands. I think that that's basically what they're looking for from him. I know they view it as basically a $12 million a year contract because they traded, you know, the Andrew Nicholson deal in it, but, you know, they actually do have to pay him whatever it is, 18 point
right.
whatever million a year. And if they want to move him, then it's an 18 point whatever it is, million dollar a year deal for whoever's going to absorb it. But they're playing basically with Monopoly money still at this point. Like, they're not going anywhere special anytime soon. So salaries are sort of irrelevant. They just want to get guys that do specific things well. And I think if he continues to shoot well and play, you know, average to above average defense at the two and the three, that's all they really want for him. And I don't know that he's going to have the opportunity to break out, if you want to call it that, because again, this is going to be an offense that's going to be run by Jeremy Lin and D'Angelo Russell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would guess he'll get like a slight uptick in terms of volume, but I don't think he's going to suddenly start averaging 20 shots or 20 points a game. But yeah, I mean, I think you're spot on. If he like settles in as that number three option, basically like what Otto Porter is in Washington, that's great. Like, that's all they need from him. Mort, they have no incentive to tank this year because their pick is headed to Cleveland unprotected. Mm. But this is the last year, so they actually have draft capital after this year. So though they have no incentive to tank, they also have a bunch of young prospects, you know, who are just kind of, that populates a lot of their roster. So who are you most excited to see among their young guys? So you got like Caris LeVert, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, Isaiah Whitehead, Jared Allen, as we mentioned before. Any of those guys really catch your eye?
I say Whitehead just because of the potential. He did not have a great season last year, admittedly, but he did have those few games where I was kind of noticing, oh, he's got a little bit of swagger to him. Mm-hmm. Like, he's got that hesitation dribble. He also shot a little bit better from downtown than I actually thought, because he was very inefficient when he was at Seton Hall. So I'm kind of hoping that he takes a step up this year and seems to deliver a little bit more. I like those guys who come in underrated and then keeps building up, and I think he's got great size for the point guard position. I'm not sure whether he's like a full clear-cut point guard or if he's better suited just playing off the ball,
mm-hmm.
but we'll see. I just like the potential. And LeVert, obviously, like he really showed a lot last year. He's played primarily small forward, so it's also going to be interesting to see if he can play some shooting guard minutes. You have a lot of guys at the wing position that need minutes, so that in itself is going to be a little bit tricky. Maybe they're, like you suggested, Brian, maybe they have to go super, super small at some point and play some of their shooting guards at power forward. I'm not sure, but that at least that could be interesting. It's going to space the four at least. But yeah, the only guy I'm sort of hesitant a little bit on is Hollis-Jefferson. I need to see that jump shot before I really, really get excited. I love the energy. I love the rebounding. I love the defense, the intensity, the energy level. But that jump shot, that needs to come around. Mm-hmm. It really does. Otherwise, you're going to put a cap on his career.
Yeah. I mean, he reminds me of like a poor man's Michael Gilchrist, basically.
Yeah. Yep.
But I'm glad that Brooklyn has realized, because he has no jump shot, put him at the four. Like, if you put him at the three, he's just screwed. But if you put him at the four, like, you know, he's at least somewhat of a mismatch offensively. Like, even if he doesn't have the jump shot, he's probably quicker than a lot of the bigger guys who are going to be guarding him. Yeah. And, you know, he's got the body to defend fours, especially now that most of the league is going small anyway. So I'm actually intrigued by him. I think he, you know, the Nets, like, sneaky I just, we've talked about this before, but Sean Marks, their general manager, deserves so much credit for how much young, intriguing talent they've added in the last 18 months, despite having almost no way to add it with, you know, their draft pick situation. It was just like what he inherited was the worst situation in the league. And he somehow turned that into, you know, he has Russell, Halas Jefferson, LeVert, Whitehead, Jared Allen. Like, that's a really impressive young haul. And those guys might not turn out to be superstars, aside from possibly Russell, but like, they're all good young role players, which is what the Nets did not have 18 months ago. So, once again, round of applause to Sean Marks. Let's move on to the Boston Celtics, who had quite an offseason of their own, highlighted by the recent acquisition of Kyrie Irving. So, Sarah, let's start there. Kyrie, you know, when he made his trade request, part of it was to get out from LeBron James's wing. He basically said, you know, he wanted to, like, push his limits and see how far he could go and see if he could be the face of a team. So, he's now in Boston. You know, he and Gordon Hayward might split that responsibility. Like, Al Horford will happily cede the spotlight to those guys, and he'll just be the number three option. So do you think Kyrie Irving has an MVP caliber campaign in him this year?
No, I mean, no, not MVP. I just don't think he does enough else besides scoring to be a legitimate MVP candidate. Of course, you know, stranger things have happened, but I don't see that in the cards this season, but I am intrigued, you know, that said, because he does have this new situation. I'm sure he feels he has a bit of a chip on his shoulder, wants to see what he can do for himself and maybe to prove some things to some other people. So I'm interested to just see how he attacks this season. Is he going to try to, you know, be a flamethrower and just destroy everyone in front of him? Is he going to try to show that he can run a team a little more than maybe what he's shown before? That's what I'm looking at this season. What's his approach to this year?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm interested to see whether Brad Stevens can unlock him as more than just a scorer. Like, it seems like he's a creative enough coach where we're going to see different facets of Kyrie's game. And I'm most excited to see that, because, you know, I don't think he's not going to enter the year as even like a top three MVP candidate, but I think he could like enter that dark horse race and like at least move into the top five by the end of the year. Not sure it's going to happen. I know your boy Kawhi. I know. I know he's going to, you know, he enters as one of the front runners. So I don't know if he's going to overtake Kawhi, especially because, you know,
Kawhi is better.
What, that? but, you know, the defense is a concern for sure. But I do think we're looking at a career year for Kyrie, as long as all of these Boston guys can kind of click quickly in training camp. But it seems like they're all going to put their egos aside, which is what they need.
I actually have a question about Kyrie for everyone here. So when he came into the league as the first pick, like, obviously there's always some sort of pressure on you, especially going number one. And he did play three seasons in Cleveland, so there was that, you know, responsibility of trying to carry a franchise. But he was young, so there's also this understanding of him acclimating to the league. Now, this is the first time there's ever been, like, hardcore pressure on him from start to finish. Like, for what Boston gave up for him, and now coming into this traditional team and, you know, really having to be, like, the number one guy, because that's what they basically said that he's going to be. Like, he's been playing with LeBron for three seasons, and I'm just sitting there going, can he deliver on that sort of pressure? Where do you guys stand on that? Because I'm not sure at all.
Jared, what do you think?
I think that it's not clear that a Kyrie-led team can go anywhere special. You know, we saw him have, like you said, 3 years of opportunity to do it, and the Cavs did basically nothing. The good thing for the Celtics is that this isn't a Kyrie-led team. He's either the second or third best player on the team, certainly behind Gordon Hayward and maybe behind Al Horford. And All they really need him to do is basically what he did in Cleveland with a little bit more ball movement involved. And Brad Stevens pushes everybody to move the ball more. So I don't know that I agree that necessarily all of the pressure is on him in terms of the actual way they play on the court. Maybe external pressure, you know, for his impact to be perceived as being more than it was in Cleveland just because of the way he orchestrated his move out of there.
Right. Yeah. That's fair. Personally, I'm still looking at the way that he has, yeah, exactly as you said, Jared, the way he maneuvered himself to get out of Cleveland, like him wanting that role, it's also encouraging in the same light. I just think that when you had LeBron as sort of like a fallback for three seasons, there's going to be a long period of adjustment when you are one of the, you said he's probably not going to be like the main cog in it like Gordon Hayward is. But I could have just imagined him coming to the Celtics that he probably has a different hat on in that respect. I think Kyrie himself looks at this situation as going, I have to be the alpha male. And there's no two ways about it.
Oh, yeah. He thought that he was the alpha male in Cleveland, too. But
yeah.
Yeah, that is true. So, Jared, let's talk about the other alpha male, as you mentioned, Gordon Hayward. He's reunited with his former college coach in Brad Stevens, just put up career best numbers in his final year in Utah. So what do you expect out of him this year in Boston?
I expect him to do pretty much the same things he's been doing in Utah over the last couple of years. He's going to play on and off the ball. He's going to play good defense at the two and the three. He'll occasionally, step into sort of a small ball four role. He's going to do anything and everything. He's going to be really damn good at it. I don't know that you can be much better than he was last year. You know, he was at, what was it, like 22, I think, 22, 5, and 4, something like that, shot almost 50, 40, 90. He was at like, I think it was like 46, 40, and 85 or something like that. So he was, you know, really damn good offensively. And then certainly he plays good defense at both wing positions as well. So I basically just expect to see even more of that. And he's going to get even better looks at the basket because he's got more threatening offensive teammates now. Like, I don't know necessarily that he has definitively better teammates. Like, George Hill was really good last year. Rudy Gobert is, either better than everybody on the Celtics or close to it. So he had good teammates in Utah last year, but he also had more of a responsibility to carry the entire offensive load. And now he's got Al Horford and Kyrie Irving and several other guys that can make plays either on their own or for others. So he's going to be really good, but that's not to say that he wasn't already really good in the first place. So what I mean is, he's going to be really good, and there's going to be like, oh my God, Gordon Hayward's a superstar now? The guy was already a superstar. Yeah. He just played in Utah, not Boston.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree. Yep. Totally, totally. And I'm glad you brought up the defense, too, because I think that flew somewhat under the radar, and Ben Dowsett of Basketball Insiders, who's a big Utah fan, was like pounding the table last year and being like, hey guys, Gordon Hayward like plays good defense now. Pay attention.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be a really valuable, you know, losing Jay Crowder, I think, is going to hurt Boston a lot, but Hayward and then some combination of guys we'll talk about right now, actually, will help make up for that. So Mort, they've got Kyrie at the one. You got Hayward, whatever. Brad Stevens doesn't believe in positions. So Hayward, yeah. Marcus Morris as some combination of wing forward, Horford at center. Who's the fifth guy in that starting lineup, do you think? Is it Marcus Smart? Is it Jaylen Brown? Is it Jason Tatum? Is it someone else I'm forgetting?
Oh, yeah. It's probably going to come down to Smart and Jaylen Brown. Smart has dropped 20 pounds and looks great.
Muscle wise,
by the way. Yeah, muscle watch for sure. Like, he looks really, really good. But I'm not sure whether I actually prefer him coming off the bench. There is definitely something to that. Have this two-way guy coming off the pine and playing 28 minutes and just ravaging hell on everyone else. So I would probably give the position to Jaylen Brown, also because he's a little bit more versatile. He's a little bit bigger. He's very athletic. And I know Brad Stevens doesn't believe in positions. That's great. I'm all for that. But he can play multiple positions still. Where, you know, he can actually go up and guard like small power forwards, and he's quick enough to guard like bigger ones. Mm-hmm. He's very versatile defensively. So, yeah, I'm probably gonna give that to Jaylen Brown. And by the way, I know that Marcus Smart guarded Paul Millsap in the playoffs. God. So I'm not gonna say that Smart isn't versatile as a defender, but at least Brown has the size, and I like the fit of Smart coming off the bench anyway. So I'm kind of hoping that's the dynamic.
Yeah, I agree with that. And if I hear one more Boston fan bring up Marcus Smart guarded Paul Millsap in the playoffs, we get it. We saw. We all watched the playoffs as
well.
Oh,
come on. It was ridiculous.
I know. I mean, it was really impressive. It was so good. Like, that's what every Boston fan, every time they talk about like trading Marcus Smart, and they're always like, no, we can't trade Marcus Smart. He guarded Paul Millsap in the playoffs.
Well, I've just decided to, like, it's Boston fans has become a little bit white noise to me. So, yeah, this summer.
Yeah, I wish I could tune them out, but unfortunately, we're going to have quite the rivalry over the next half decade. So I'm preparing my war now. But yeah, I agree with you, Mort. I think Jaylen Brown, you know, again, you just don't need to care about positional designations. I don't care who is the, you know, quote unquote shooting guard, if it's Gordon Hayward or Jaylen Brown. Like, you have three rangy, versatile forwards in Brown, Hayward, Marcus Morris. Just trot them out, figure out who they guard. You know, it doesn't matter. Like, Morris will guard power forwards, and then between Hayward and Brown, just do it on a night to night basis. But yeah, I think Smart off the bench.
Yeah, and switch accordingly.
Yeah, exactly. It just gives them such a dynamic starting five. And I'm sure that including Jay Crowder in that Kyrie trade, like, part of the consideration, I'm sure, was we have Jaylen Brown and we have Jason Tatum, both of whom play the same, you know, quote unquote, play the same position as Jay Crowder. So, like, that created more opportunity for those two guys, which I think, you know, ultimately it might hurt the Celtics in the short term because they're just younger and less experienced, and Jay Crowder fit that 3-and-D role really well, but it should behoove them in the long run because you're getting those guys meaningful reps. So by the time the playoffs come around, you know, they're not like wet behind the ears. They'll actually have played a full season and played meaningful minutes. Sarah, before we move on from the Celtics, Ian Levy of FanSided, who we've had on before, you know, he does these daily email threads for the Step Back. It was either yesterday or the day before, he posed the question of whether the Boston Celtics actually got worse this summer instead of better, given all of their turnover. I think they have like four players coming back from last year's team. So a lot of new faces in Boston. Where do you stand on that? Do you think they're going to be better or worse than they were last year?
So you threw it to the Spurs fan for the continuity talk?
Yeah, sure did.
There's definitely something to be said for continuity, no question. Of course, you know, Spurs are getting dogged, well, for many reasons, but for basically bringing the same team back, which, you know, there are some pros to that. That said, I really think eventually Boston's going to be better off. I think they have a lot of young talent, so it may not pay off right away, but I do think hopefully once they get rolling, even maybe towards the end of this season, we start to see that. I think, you know, Jason Tatum has a lot of potential. Hopefully, I'd like to see him kind of sneak into the starting lineup eventually, though I'm not clear that it would happen this year. With Mort, that Brown is probably a good choice right now. No, I don't think so. I think they are going to be better. I don't think they got worse, but yes, there may be a dip initially because they're having to adjust to so much turnover. I think that's to be expected.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable take. I'm trying to pull up his argument here.
While you're looking that up, I think it should be noted that the Celtics outperformed their point differential by 5 wins last season. And that even if they get better, they may not have a better record than they did last year because they weren't actually as good as they were last year.
That's a really good point. Yeah. Let me see if I can find... Okay, here we go. So his argument was they replaced Isaiah with Kyrie. He finds it hard to believe Irving will produce at the historic levels Isaiah did last season. Replacing Jay Crowder with Hayward was a big offensive upgrade, but a smaller yet still important defensive downgrade. Replaced Olynyk with Aaron Baines. Replaced Amir Johnson and Jonas Derebko with Marcus Morris. Lost Avery Bradley, Marcus Smart and Jaylen Brown will split those minutes, so offensive downgrade, slight defensive improvement. So a lot of it was also, you know, losing some depth, the continuity thing. I think there's an argument there, but I'm with you, Sarah, that by the time the playoffs roll around, it doesn't matter, like, if they don't win as many games. The question is, are they more or less competitive with Cleveland? And I think, you know, Cleveland also underwent a lot of changes, and I guess we'll have to see. Like, if Isaiah Thomas isn't healthy, I'd say Boston, you know, by the time playoffs roll around, will be the favorite to make it out of the East. But, like, given how badly Cleveland embarrassed them in the Eastern Conference Finals last year, I think it was good of the Celtics to realize they had to do something drastic to kind of, you know, push this thing forward. And I think they will be more competitive against the likes of Cleveland, maybe Golden State. I mean, I think Golden State could still handle them pretty easily in the finals if that were to happen. But, you know, at least they're moving in the right direction, even if it meant cashing in some of Danny Ainge's long prized assets. So that's where I stand on the Celtics. Jared, let's move to the Toronto Raptors, who, you know, they also lost some valuable depth. But I think the big question there, at least to start, is DeMar DeRozan, who, you know, he put up career best numbers last year, close to like 27 points per game, shouldered even more of an offensive load than he already has. Still isn't shooting three-pointers at a high volume. I think he had 0.4 per game. After the playoff ended, or after they lost in the playoffs, Dwayne Casey said, you know, that's kind of his next step. He needs to start shooting threes, and there have been videos coming out this summer showing him doing so. So do you think this is the year he actually adds that to his game, or does he need to?
No, DeMar DeRozan is not going to start shooting threes. We hear this every damn year. It's not going to happen.
Probably so, yeah. Do you think he needs to be like a top 20 player, or do you think he's fine just being this like mid-range god?
I don't know that even if he starts shooting threes, he'd be a top 20 player. I think he's, you know, in the range of that anyway, probably, you know, in the 10, 15 spots behind that range. But if just because he starts shooting threes doesn't mean he's going to start making threes.
Right.
So, you know, I think if he does what he did last year, that's all the Raptors are going to need from him. He's still not their best player. That's still Kyle Lowry. But he provides something really important for them, and especially with the depth that they lost this offseason, I think it's really important that he soaks up a whole lot of possessions and scores at an above average clip of efficiency.
Yeah, which is what he did last year. So I'm assuming he's going to be at least, again, north of 25 points per game. Because as you mentioned, they lost a couple valuable role players. They did, however, they picked up CJ Miles from the Pacers. Mm-hmm. Now they lost Amari Carroll. They lost PJ Tucker. They lost Patrick Patterson. So basically all their options from the three last year are now gone. Who do you think starts at the three this year? Do you think Miles gets that de facto, or do you think Norman Powell has a chance?
Well, with Bruno Capoccio still being 1 year away now, I think it should be CJ Miles. Better size, better volume shooter, also better efficiency, if I'm not mistaken. I haven't really looked at Norman Powell's numbers. I know he's still a strong shooter, but he's just not the same caliber of Miles. And with DeMar not taking that three-point shot, or more importantly, not hitting those three-point shots, mm-hmm. you just need that sort of spacing going forward. And CJ also adds that element. He can actually play a little bit of small ball four as well, so you can move him around a little bit better. But and again, Powell is a strong defender and an upcoming two-way player. So much like the argument I made for Marcus Smart coming off the bench as just a beast, I would like to see Norman Powell get that opportunity and get those added extra minutes that the bench openings open up for.
Yeah, I think Miles is better suited to be like a complimentary option, and he doesn't need that many touches. He can serve as more of a catch-and-shoot threat, as you alluded to. Whereas Powell, like, I think he has the potential to kind of be a microwave scorer off the bench, especially with Terrence Ross gone. Like, that's, he, you know, I wouldn't be totally shocked if he's in the sixth man of the year race, especially, you know, early on.
I would be shocked if he wasn't.
Yeah. Well, my boy Dario. We all know my boy Dario is going to win.
Yo, well, oh my God, here comes the Philly love. You said six man race, Brian. It's not all Philly.
Right. It's not going to be a race. Yeah. It's a race for second place because Dario's going to win.
Oh, yeah. So okay.
Norm will be in contention for second place.
This next team we have up, I'm just going to tune you out for 25 damn minutes. Yeah.
Probably the best play.
Yeah.
Sarah, do you think the Raptors are ever going to stop hating Jonas Valanciunas? Or is he, like, are they ever going to play him more than 30 minutes a game? Or do you think, you know, they've talked about sliding Ibaka to the five at times. Both Jakob Poeltl and Pascal Siakam played well at Summer League, and it sounds like they're going to start pushing him for minutes. Do you think he, like, staves off all of these challenges and finally breaks out? Or is this just who he is in Toronto?
Yeah, it's, you can basically go back to what Jared said about is DeMar finally going to start shooting threes? Are they going to, you know, play him more minutes and give him more touches? No, we've talked about this the last few years, and it's just, I think we've passed that point. It's not going to happen at this point. You know, I wouldn't mind being wrong about that, but I don't see it. I don't really love the guys around him, you know, the other options, but I'm sure that the Raptors are going to mess around with that a little bit. They're not going to play Jonas 30 minutes plus, so we'll see how that goes.
Yeah,
I'm on the same page. His value is as a guy that can soak up a lot of possessions and use them, you know, at above average efficiency, but that's not going to happen on this team because there are two considerably better options to do that. And if you're a big guy that isn't touching the ball a lot offensively and you can't stretch the floor, and on the other end you can't protect the rim or defend in space, then you're not a guy who should be playing over 30 minutes a game. So it's not going to happen.
Yeah. He just doesn't offer the type of rim protection they need. I like the idea of, I don't want Ibaka to be their full-time starting five, but I like the idea of playing him there in small ball units. I think, you know, it could be interesting, especially because he can now space the floor. He's hitting threes at least an average rate. Hopefully he gets his shot blocking numbers back up. And then I'm interested to see what they have in these young guys. Like, they didn't play all that much last year, but, like, both of those guys really showed flashes in Summer League. And, like, all the reports from training camp that I'm seeing are pretty glowing so far about both of them. So, you know, they shopped JV for much of the summer, couldn't find a taker because no one can trade a big man in today's NBA, and it seems like I don't think they're going to, like, shoehorn him in for 35 minutes a game just to boost his trade value. It just seems like he's destined to play somewhere around 25, 28 minutes a game.
They should move him for Robin Lopez, actually. That would make so much sense for the Raptors. They get a legitimate, you know, rim protector, a guy who on occasion can switch out a little bit, a great offensive rebounder as well. That would just make so much sense to me.
Yeah, and the Bulls, they have no incentive to play defense, so that would actually help them too.
No, right? Mm-hmm. And Jonas is still, I believe, 24. You know, he turned 25, but still, it's young enough to still jump on that core, right?
Right. So, yeah. Well, he's then 10 years too young to be on the Bulls.
Oh, obviously, yeah. But, I mean, look, he was drafted 6 years ago, so it's adding another lottery pick.
That's true. Right. That is a good point. Yeah. The Karpak's pitch. Jared, before we move on to the Sixers, let's talk about the point guard spot. You mentioned Kyle Lowry as their best player. They lost Corey Joseph, and, like, I don't think the CJ Miles thing ended up being a sign-in trade, like, officially, but it was a de facto sign-in trade, so they traded Corey Joseph to the Pacers, and then CJ Miles just, like, oh, coincidentally signed in Toronto. So now all they have behind Lowry is DeLon Wright and Fred VanVleet. Lowry has had issues staying healthy, especially toward the ends of seasons. Last year, he had a wrist injury picked up right after the All-Star break, caused him to miss like the final month and a half almost. If or when Kyle Lowry goes down again for an extended period, do you think DeLon or Fred can carry the load in his absence?
Nope.
Yep, that was easy.
Yeah, well, Lowry is, you know, either the second or third best point guard in the East. He's, you know, like DeRozan, like a top 20 to 30 player. You know, I think considerably better than DeRozan because of what he brings on defense, the fact that he can shoot threes. He's really good. Like, you're not replacing him with DeLon Wright or Fred VanVleet, especially with, you know, the fact that they lost a bunch of depth this year. It's just, they cannot withstand a Kyle Lowry injury.
Yeah, it seems I understand why they had to lose Joseph, because, you know, they needed to fill that void at the three. But like, it really feels like this team is playing with fire, where if Lowry goes down and it's not like he has a perfect track record of health, like, they could go plunging down the standings. And I guess the only consolation is that the East is so bad that it would really take like a full season injury for them to probably fall out of the playoff race. But Of the big four in the East, Toronto's the one I'm feeling least confident about, just because, you know, they lack, I guess Washington's depth isn't great either, but they lack some real depth behind their most important pieces, and it has me a little worried. Mort, it's time. The moment you've been waiting for. Let's talk about the Sixers. We're not going to start with Joel Embiid because I need a couple minutes to emotionally prepare for that. So let's start with Ben Simmons, who is playing 5-on-5. You know, he suffered the foot fracture last year in training camp, missed his entire rookie season, missed summer league, playing 5-on-5 now, quote unquote, dominating the gym. We've started to see some videos trickle out from scrimmages and such where, you know, he's running. They weren't kidding. He is their like full-time ball handler, you know, in half-court sets. Brett Brown has said, you know, in transition, Markel can run it too. But like half-court sets, they are really running their offense through Ben Simmons. So how do you see that working out for the Sixers this year?
That's an impossible question because we have only seen him in summer league so far. Mm-hmm. But if we based on what we saw in summer league last season, it's really encouraging. Like, he can make some extremely difficult passes, and he can make passes on the run when he's entering the post and it's like slowing down. It seems like he constantly has this court awareness regardless of how fast the entire offense is moving. So it's really encouraging to hear that he's doing this even in half court sets. Right now, he's also spent a whole year on the bench, like soaking up players' tendencies. So he comes in knowing, okay, this guy likes the ball here, this guy likes it here. So that's a great asset to have. And if he can become like a Giannis Antetokounmpo sort passer, or even like LeBron passer-esque, that's obviously going to be huge. I would still like to see that jump shot come around, so that could open up a little bit more space, because that's also going to open up his passing game more. Mm-hmm. But if, you know, I'm encouraged, obviously.
Yeah. Hey, I saw one clip of him dribbling in transition, and he pulled up for like a 12-foot off-balance jumper that looked ugly as hell, but it went in. So I'll take it.
12-foot. Yeah.
Yeah. It was not. I have not seen a single 3-point shot from him. Probably for good reason. And yeah, that's obviously the big concern with him coming into the year. And it was interesting. Brett Brown said, he acknowledged, like, because of that limitation, it really does restrict the type of players you can put around Simmons, which, you know, we can talk about Darius Saric a little bit later if we need to. But it like begs the question of whether Simmons and Saric can ever see the floor together, because Saric is not a great 3-point shooter either. So it seems like Brown is basically saying, I need 4 above average long range shooters next to Simmons, because you know, we can't play another guy who can't space the floor. So it doesn't bode well for a guy like Jahlil Okafor, who doesn't have that three-point shot. Like, it seems to bode well for Rashawn Holmes if Embiid is forced to miss time. Jared Bayless, I think, is actually going to see a little bit more time than one might expect. You know, he missed most of his, like, all the three games last year with a wrist injury.
But are we closing the door on Dario Saric as a shooter?
No.
I don't think so. I mean, he's so young. He still canned over 100 triples last year. I know it's only on 31%, but I mean, good Lord. I mean, there's some potential there, and look what he played with when Embiid was out.
Yeah,
so.
I know. Yeah, I mean, they still have this big man logjam, which is not going to get resolved anytime soon, but like, a Simmons-Saric 4-5 combo would be really interesting. You know, you're going to lack some rim protection, but like, both of those guys can pass the ball like wizards. So it would really, at least, you know, you're probably giving up 110 points on defense, but you might be scoring 112 per 100 possessions on offense. So maybe it makes up for it. All right, Sarah, I'm ready to talk about Embiid. Let's do it. They have not cleared him for 5-on-5 yet. He's been like working off to the side in training camp. They say he's targeting the first game of the season, but he's already come out and said, like, do I think I'm going to play 82 games? No, that's not realistic. So if or when he is forced to miss time, do you think Rashawn Holmes and Jahlil Okafor are enough to hold down the fort?
Well, we've talked about Rashawn Holmes. We like him. I think we're not going to replace what Embiid can do, obviously. The guy is completely game-changing, season-changing type individual. We know that. But I think Holmes is a really intriguing kind of role man. Okafor, you know, he does have a nice back-to-the-basket game that, you know, we've seen become an endangered species in the league these days, but you know, yeah, it's gonna be a hit. Obviously, you know that. I don't have to tell you that, Brian. if Embiid can't play, it's not gonna be great. But you know, Holmes is something to try to be optimistic about for sure.
Yeah, I mean, Holmes, as I mentioned, the fact that he can shoot threes, I think if Embiid or when Embiid is forced to miss time, I think he will be the starting center, just because of the concerns Brett Brown has with Ben Simmons and spacing. As I'm really starting to talk myself into skinny Okafor again, and I feel really dirty about it. Like, I he hasn't played with an above average point guard ever. So like, maybe having someone who can actually get him an entry pass at, like, you know, when he posts up and like actually get him an entry pass on time where they can't double team him right away. Like, maybe there's a little bit of hope. He lost, like, 20 pounds this offseason, so maybe he's not going to be as slow-footed defensively. Am I just grasping
at straws? Is this the bargaining stage?
Yeah, I think so. Probably. Yeah. But Zach Harper of FanRag Sports actually had a really good piece about Okafor today and, like, kind of what realistic expectations are for him moving forward and whether he can bounce back. So I would encourage everyone to check that out at FanRag Sports, because I think, you know, I don't think Okafor is a lost cause. I don't know if he's ever going to hit a ceiling in Philly, especially if Embiid's healthy. He's not, because they can't play together. But, you know, if Embiid, God forbid, was forced to miss the whole season, I still think Holmes is going to play more minutes than him. So, I think there is an opportunity for him elsewhere to thrive. I don't know if it's ever going to happen in Philly, but I don't think we should, like, completely write him off as a bust already. I think the knee injury that lingered since like March of 2016 has contributed, you know, him having to play next to Nerlens for a lot of the year, and like that just clogs your spacing so badly because those two can't shoot. You know, I think in the right situation, Okafor could be at least like an average NBA player. I don't think he's ever going to return positive value on the number three pick, but I don't think he's a total bust as of yet. Jared, Basketball Twitter, as it is wont to do, freaked out this week because Mike Schmitz of ESPN, formerly of Draft Express, posted a video from Sixers training camp with Markelle Fultz shooting some ugly-looking free throws. The release point was just totally different than what he did at Washington, and he bricked one, and it just looked like you know, his free throw percentage at Washington was not great as is, and he basically looked like Dwight Howard trying to shoot at the line. He luckily came out and said he was just kind of tinkering with it, and he's not going to actually do that in real games. He was just playing around with it. But what do you think, you know, what do you think expectations are for Markelle Fultz this year as the number one pick, but, you know, playing alongside a fellow number one pick in Ben Simmons, and then, again, knock on wood, also a game-changing talent in Joel Embiid?
I think there's probably a pretty big difference between what Sixers fans' expectations are, what basketball Twitter's expectations are, what the actual Sixers' expectations are, and what the expectations should be. Sixers fans' expectations are basically that he's going to be an all-star right away. Basketball Twitter's expectations are basically that he's going to be really good offensively and really bad defensively. The Sixers' expectations probably fall somewhere in between that. You know, actual expectations to me, I think, like, people need to remember that most rookies are bad. Joel Embiid stepping on the court and immediately being, like, during the time he's on the floor, one of, like, the 30 best players in the league last year, if not better than that, is wildly out of the ordinary, and we shouldn't expect that from Fultz, and we shouldn't expect that from Simmons. I think that if he scores, if he shoots well off the catch, if he shows the ability to create his own shot, not even necessarily make it yet, I think it's important to just see that he can actually get his own shot against NBA defenses, which I don't think will be a problem for him. Like, that's a skill that is pretty transferable, and I think he'll be able to do that. Those are the things that I want to see from him, and I want to see him actually, like, give a shit that the defensive end of the floor exists, which was right. not the case at Washington. So for me, that's what I'm looking for. I know Sixers fans are looking for a heck of a lot more than that. I think they should be prepared to be disappointed on that front because, again, most rookies are bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's going to come down to, you know, because they gave up what could be so much to get him. They gave up number three and then what could be the number two pick in either 2018 or 2019. And because there was the Fultz versus Ball debate, like...
Yeah, there was not a debate to me. Like, he was the best player in the draft. He was the number one pick. He's going to be really good. It's just probably not going to happen this year.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be similar to the Frankie Smokes versus Dennis Smith thing. Like, if Dennis Smith puts up big numbers and Frankie Smokes takes a little bit of time, people are going to say, oh, the Knicks screwed up. And then, like, Lonzo, they are clearly building their entire team around Lonzo Ball. So, like, he's going to put up better numbers than Markelle Fultz as a rookie. I'm pretty convinced of that. Like, Lonzo is the front runner to win Rookie of the Year. Fultz is, like, fourth or fifth on the list. He's behind Lonzo, Dennis Smith, and Ben Simmons. So, like, I'm keeping my expectations in check for Fultz. I think that, as you mentioned, Jared, defense is definitely something I hope to see more. You know, he had, like, his steals and blocks numbers were actually pretty good in Washington because he would, like, do these, like, highlight reel chase down blocks. But, like, just on a possession-by-possession basis, I want him to be more locked in on that end. And I think, you know, playing alongside guys like Simmons, Embiid, J.J. Redick, Robert Covington, he won't have to take over. Like, at Washington, he was the only reliable offensive option on that team. So, like, he had to devote so much attention to that end that he couldn't probably, like, save his energy for defense. So I'm hoping that we see a little bit more well-roundedness from him, even if it comes at the expense of his scoring. And then offensively, I've been saying it all summer, like, the only thing that could really thwart this Simmons-Fultz thing from taking off. Like, we've seen teams with multiple ball handlers. That's only a benefit as long as those guys keep their ego in check. And, like, if Fultz is really okay with, you know, he was a point guard at Washington, but he's going to play, like, mostly off the ball as, like, a rich man's Patrick Beverley, like what he did in Houston last year, then that's great. And that, like, that partnership could really thrive. But if, like, if the Sixers get off to a rough start and Simmons struggles early and Fultz starts demanding the ball more, you know, things could go south quickly. So I'm just hoping to see those guys all put their egos aside and, like, just do whatever is best for the team and listen to Brett Brown and, like, just stick to the system. Robert Covington is eligible for renegotiation and extension come mid-November. The Sixers saved, I think, about $15 million in cap space this offseason, which I do not believe was an accident. So Covington's already said they're talking about an extension. He's hopeful to sign one. So if you're the Sixers, how much are you willing to give Covington once that mid-November deadline rolls around?
Yeah, probably $15 million a year. Sounds about right. I mean, look at the market. He's a strong defender. He can shoot. He had a little down year, though. He's a great rebounder for a wing. He can play the four. He can play the three. I'm really digging his fit for Philly. And I know a lot of people are looking at him, oh, he's not like a long-term piece of the puzzle. I think he is. His defense is extremely valuable. And $15 million a year, I don't think that's an overpay.
Yeah. I'm cautiously optimistic that they'll get him for less, like, just because of the market dynamics this summer, and he knows next summer it's going to be even worse. You know, if you can get him at 4 years, $50 million, I do that in like immediately. So I think he's definitely, you're right, he's definitely a piece of the future there. You know, he hasn't shot above 40% from three since his rookie year in Houston. He's never shot above 40% overall, actually, in his 3 years in Philly. But again, it's the same thing with Okafor. Like, he hasn't, probably the best point guard he's played with is Ish Smith. No offense to Ish, but, like, you know, that's not Ben Simmons or Markel Fultz. So I think having those guys, having Embiid, having Redick, like, he's going to shoot a career high from the field this year, and as you mentioned, Mort, his defense is superb. You know, it's a running joke on basketball Twitter that, like, it's when you bring up Robert Covington, you always have to mention that he led the league in deflections per 36 minutes, but he did, and that wasn't, like, the prior season he was right up there too. So not only does he come up with a lot of steals, but he's just such a crafty swarming defender that, you know, thwarting passing lanes, like Nerlens Noel back when he was in Philly did that too. Like, he didn't come up with a steal every time, but just getting in the way and making that your opponent have to think that extra millisecond, like, can make a difference. So I really hope to see Covington signed to an extension, part of the long-term future. He's been there since the beginning. He is the embodiment. You know, the process was draft picks and undrafted players, like 10-day contracts, undrafted free agents. So you got the draft picks and Embiid, Simmons, Fultz. Covington and TJ McConnell are the other side of that. So I hope both of those guys stick around, frankly. All right, let's move in to our division predictions. So how we see the division shaking out from top to bottom. Sarah, let's start with you.
Let's go Boston. Toronto. Let's see.
I know you're not.
Oh, you're thinking about it.
You are not about to pick one of these terrible New York teams over the Sixers.
Yeah, you are.
I just wanted to make you think a little bit. Yeah. Sixers and Nets and Knicks.
Knicks last. Jared, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody's probably going to have the same top three. And then, like, the Knicks and Nets, mm-hmm. I mean, who cares? They're both going to be really bad. one will be worse than the other by accident.
Yeah, that's a good way of phrasing it. Mort, how do you see? Same top three, and then do you have a preference on Knicks or Nets?
Yeah, Knicks at the bottom. Mm-hmm. But I will say this, because of all the new faces in Boston, and assuming that Kyle Lowry stays healthy, it wouldn't surprise me if Toronto actually was the better overall record team. Not that there would be the better team in the playoffs, but I wouldn't be surprised if Toronto had a better record at the end of the regular season.
Interesting.
I mean, well, it's probably not by much, even if it is, right. But I'm just saying they probably still finish first, Boston, mm-hmm. but just saying it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, four guys returning, a lot of rookies, a lot of second year players. It's just, there's an adjustment period, obviously.
Yeah, I think I want to say Matt Moore of CBS Sports has been pimping Toronto as a possible number one seed in the East reason. But again, it's like everything has to break right. If Lowry goes down, if DeRozan goes down, lights out on that dream. But yeah, I mean, I don't think it's it's not the most outlandish thing you've predicted on this podcast. I'll give you that.
I can't even count all the outlandish things I've said on this podcast. Yeah. So.
I really erred on the side of going second with them because I just assumed something's probably going to go wrong health-wise.
Yeah. In true Toronto fashion, Kyle Lowry has to miss at least 20 games. Yeah, but I'm Boston, Toronto, Philly. I think Nets are pretty clearly above the Knicks. I think the Knicks defense is just going to be an absolute tire fire this year. And I mean, they're going to be, I don't know, I think they might be a bottom three team in the league now. I think it's them, the Bulls, and I guess Phoenix. But they are going to be a special kind of awful to watch. But good for them for at least tanking at the right year. So, Sarah, how many playoff teams do you see coming out of this division?
Well, you know, I toyed with wanting to put the Sixers in, but I don't think I can do it just yet. there's definitely some talent there, but I don't think I can, so I'm going to go to, like you said, Boston and Toronto. Although there are teams that I want to keep my eye on. Like, I'm putting Charlotte in tentatively, but you know, we talked about the fit there with Dwight, and was it Fansided or FanRag? I should have paid more attention, but there was an article that just came out a few days ago, talked about Atlanta players being thrilled when Dwight was traded.
Yeah, so, that was from a Zach Lowe like podcast appearance or something, but yeah.
Okay, so yeah, that, you know, that could blow up, and if it does, they could be in some big trouble. So we'll see.
I like you almost putting the Sixers in there. I appreciate that. Jared, how about you? How many playoff teams do you see from this division?
Yeah, I got to go with two also. I think the Sixers certainly have a higher ceiling than a bunch of the other, you know, 5 to 8 contenders, if you want to call them that, in the East. But you really can't count on Joel Embiid playing, like, any games at all. So I don't know how you can pencil them in for a playoff spot.
Yeah, unfortunately. Mm. Yeah. Morton,
like, if I knew that Joel Embiid was going to play even 50 games, I'd say, like, yeah, they could probably take the 8 seed just because the four of us and Joel Embiid could probably take the 8 seed.
Right.
But, I mean, again, like, the guy has played 786 minutes in 3 years. You cannot count on him being on the floor, period.
Yeah, and the fact he hasn't been cleared at training camp, you know, he had surgery 8 months ago at this point, and it was supposed to be a pretty minor injury. You know, they're saying we're just being hyper-conservative, but I think we've all learned not to trust the Sixers medical staff with anything. So, yeah, I'm with you, Jared. I, like, at this point, I would be pleasantly surprised if we get 50 games out of Embiid, 25 minutes a game. That would be beyond my expectations.
Even that would, like, what, 50 times 25? That's 12, he'd more than 50. Double his career minutes, like 1250. Yeah. Like, that's, you know, 150. 167% of the minutes that he played last year, you know, that's even that might be expecting is probably expecting too much.
Oh yeah. No, I'm not expecting that by any means. It's like, if that is, I feel like that's probably the baseline where they could be a realistic playoff contender if you get that much out of him. But I mean, I would, at this point, I don't even know if we're going to get as much out of him this year as we did last year. These non-updates are having me increasingly pessimistic. Mort, how about you? How many playoff teams from this division?
Yeah, two at this point. If by some miracle Embiid actually plays 50-55 games, like you guys, I'm also very skeptical. Then I'm definitely thinking they could make it. However, if Embiid misses the whole year, I'm actually putting them below Brooklyn.
Whoa!
Yeah.
What? Oh my god.
Yeah, yeah.
No.
I am.
That is, oh yeah, yeah. That is just... Who's playing center for Brooklyn? We talked about this. Rashawn Holmes is better than Tofey Mozgov. Come on.
But like Jared said, which I agree with, rookies struggle. And, I mean, Ben Simmons, still a rookie. I know that he had a year on the sideline. That's going to help a lot, but he still can't shoot. Markel is going to struggle defensively. There's just so many components there that are missing. So, they are going to be a shit show if Embiid misses the whole year.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to
miss the whole year. I hope that he doesn't, obviously, because he's fantastic.
Yeah.
And he's trying so damn hard every year to get back. I feel so sorry for him. It's every year.
Yeah. It's really... It is crushing not just from a Philly perspective, but just in a, like, even if I wasn't from Philly, he would be my favorite player in the NBA right now, just because he's so goddamn entertaining, and I just want him to
there's
be
just
healthy.
Such a Grant Hill vibe to him, right? I mean, like Grant Hill in Orlando, like every damn season you're going like, oh, Grant is there, him and McGrady, it's on now, and then
I will keep my fingers crossed that he surprises us all and stays healthy the whole year and plays more than anyone could reasonably expect. But like you guys, I am taking two playoff teams. I think Detroit takes the 8th seed, and it pains me to say that. But if Embiid stays healthy, then next year I'll pencil them in for a top 4 seed, especially when LeBron James signs with them as a free agent in 2018. No reaction? Okay, cool.
No reaction. We're numb. Good. It's white noise.
All right. Yeah. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Jared, special thanks to you. Just can you remind our listeners one more time where they can find you on Twitter and where they can find your work?
Yeah, thanks for having me again. I'm on Twitter at JADubin5. You can find a link in my bio to everywhere that I write and have written. Pop up throughout the season at Vice Sports, at Fanside, it's The Step Back. Several other places as well.
Very good. Yeah, please give Jared a follow. He's a really good follow, even if you're not a Knicks fan. Just some general NBA talk always on that account as well. Again, you can find us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find all of our handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes, so please subscribe, download, leave some reviews. We'd love any feedback. And we're being hosted this year on FanRag Sports. So check them out on Twitter at FanRag Sports and for their NBA content at FanRag NBA. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined by Morten Jensen, Sarah Chalea, and Jared Dubin. Have a good one, you all.
You too, Brian.
You too.
Viva Embiid.